You're listening to the Diplomats Asia Geopolitics Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Putz, coming to you from Washington, D.C.
And this is your co-host, Ankit Panda, also in Washington. How are you, Katie?
I'm good. How are you, Ankit?
Doing well. It's a beautiful, beautiful spring here in D.C. and a lot to talk about, as always.
Yes, indeed. The cherry blossoms might have dropped off the trees, but there's lots to talk about when it comes to Japan and the U.S. That was really corny, and I don't regret it. So we are a few weeks after Japanese Prime Minister Kishida's state visit to Washington, you know, which included the fancy state dinner and a bilateral summit with President Biden, followed by the U.S.-Japan-Philippines trilateral, which we previewed in our last episode and went largely how I think we thought it would. In this episode, Ankit and I really wanted to take a good look back and highlight some of the outcomes of the U.S.-Japan bilateral summit. In a lengthy joint statement, the two parties marked a, quote, new era of U.S.-Japan cooperation and announced several new strategic initiatives. I think, unsurprisingly, the 70-some agreements that were reportedly signed during the summit run the full gamut of relations, but I think we're probably going to focus on the defense and security aspects. In that regard, Ankit, what do you take away from the summit overall? And then we can kind of dive into some of those strategic initiatives.
Yeah, so I think the first thing to say about this summit is maybe an observation that I made on the podcast a few episodes ago. You know, a lot of U.S. allies, I think, are in a bit of a rush to get certain things on paper with the United States before the election, right? And I think particularly by the summer when the Democratic and Republican conventions convene and the U.S. is in full-on election mode, I think there is this sort of impulse to get as many things as possible committed by an administration here in D.C. that is very pro-allies, pro-allied integration. I think that definitely permeated the Japanese approach to this state visit, which is the first U.S.-Japan state visit actually since Shinzo Abe's back in 2015, which was significant because that resulted in the update to the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines. But of course, the other piece of context here is that this is the first major visit of this kind since Japan announced and began to adopt its 2022 National Defense Strategy, which for the first time effectively transitioned Japan to take a more expeditionary, forward-leaning role in its own defense, including through the pursuit of counter-strike capabilities. And so a lot of what we see on the defense and security front was basically the U.S.-Japan alliance's necessary effort, in my opinion, to sort of adapt and modernize the alliance to this new reality where Japan is going to play this role. The traditional understanding of Japan's role within the alliance was that, you know, the United States would be the sword or the spear and the Japanese would be the shield. In effect, Japan's constitutional limitations on possessing offensive capabilities for the longest time meant that Japan would field kind of logistical support, intelligence capabilities to assist the United States in the Indo-Pacific more broadly. But the sort of reinterpretation of Japan's constitution that took place several years ago and the adoption of this new national defense strategy have now allowed the alliance to evolve in this really important way where Japan is going to carry a lot more weight fundamentally in projecting power, which has implications from the Korean Peninsula to the Taiwan Strait. So I think that's the broader kind of backdrop coming into this summit, which we didn't really get into when we talked about the trilateral with the Philippines. So I think it's you know, we're talking a lot about Kishida's time here in Washington, but I do think there was a lot here, especially if you go look at the joint statement. I mean, it is just so long because there's just so much done at this summit. But yeah, I think that's kind of my initial set of observations, Katie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned the joint statement because I was reading through it again today, and it is quite a long document. You know, I've read a lot of joint statements over the years, and it's definitely one of the longer ones. And just for our readers' information, you know, it is divided into several sections. I think the largest of which covers sort of defense and security issues, but there's a significant section on space. There's a section on innovation, economic security, and climate action. There's a section on global diplomacy and development, and then a final section on people-to-people ties. So it really runs that full range of relations. And the United States and Japan have a very fairly long-running at this point alliance and pretty deep. But let's go back to that sort of defense section. There are a number of initiatives that are either announced or intentions stated very clearly in that section. Which ones sort of jump out to you, Ankit?
So the big one for me, which is sort of one of my hobby horses that, you know, I I've been really interested in since Japan's national defense strategy was looming. I mean, you know, everybody knew what the national defense strategy would say. But, you know, one of the big questions and one of the big sort of gaps, arguably, once Japan adopted this new national defense strategy was alliance command and control, right? Unlike the U.S.-South Korea alliance and unlike the NATO alliance, the United States and Japan have not had an integrated alliance command and control mechanism, right? There is no combined forces command like there is in the United States Korea alliance. There's no supreme headquarters Allied Powers Europe, which coordinates military planning within NATO. And so now, I think this was something that both the Kishida administration and the Biden administration recognized as kind of low-hanging fruit, but also just a really necessary bit of work that has to happen over the next few years. So that's kind of the big thing that was agreed, I think, when it comes to defense and security. The two allies will work to set up a new, a range of new mechanisms to allow for greater coordination and interoperability between U.S. and Japanese forces, both during peacetime and during crises and conflicts. And so that means that what Japan contributes to a military campaign alongside the United States is going to be fundamentally different as a result of the new capabilities that Japan is now pursuing. And so it makes a lot of sense to kind of bring all of the command together. So that's kind of on the software side, which I think is really important. Everybody loves hardware, though, and there is a lot in this joint statement on hardware as well, right? So there is the traditional kind of, you know, since the late 1990s, the U.S. and Japan have been cooperating on missile defense pretty in pretty intimate ways, and that legacy continues with now plans to cooperate on counter-hypersonic weapons development, so basically a response to some of the threats that Japan and the United States perceive in the region. There's plans to deepen cooperation on intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance, including trilaterally with Japan, with South Korea and Australia. And the other big one that I think is really interesting is potential, the consideration, this one is really interesting that this isn't the joint statement because they don't actually commit to anything, but that the U.S. and Australia will talk about bringing Japan into Pillar 2 of AUKUS. So Pillar 2 is basically all of the AUKUS stuff that is not the nuclear propulsion submarine project. So missile development, et cetera, which the U.S. is also cooperating with Japan on. Japan is going to be buying American Tomahawks, for instance. So really a lot going on here. And I think from Japan's perspective, I'm sure the Kishida administration is very happy to have all of these commitments down on paper. Although, you know, TBD how the AUKUS Pillar 2 debates will go. And maybe we can talk about that a little more.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up because I wanted to sort of highlight in several parts of the joint statement and the outcomes of this bilateral are sort of references to the larger U.S. alliance network in Asia. You know, in that same sort of defense section, there's the mentioning of cooperation on a networked air defense architecture among the United States, Japan, and Australia. There's the considering cooperation with Japan on AUKUS Pillar 2 line, which I think that I'm sure they dickered over the specific language for a long time on that. Because, you know, as far as I understand, this is just something they're talking about, but it certainly is meaningful that it gets written down like this and sort of put out publicly, probably in part to see what the reaction and what the response is and the reception of that. So let's go a little bit deeper into that before we sort of close up, at least talking about the defense portion of this. You know, how do you see AUKUS developing sort of within the structures of the Pacific as it exists now? You know, I think I've seen, you see different references, and there's a lot of mini laterals going along these days. Trilaterals, there's the Quad, there's AUKUS, and these all sort of mean different things, but I'm curious how you see Japan fitting into that wider network of groupings.
Yeah, so I think, you know, at first look, I think there's a pretty compelling case to include Japan in the AUKUS Pillar 2 effort, right? Japan, all of the things that Japan is trying to do in its national defense strategy, including through the acquisition of counter-strike capabilities, pairs very nicely with what AUKUS Pillar 2 is trying to do for Australia. And of course, that's a trilateral arrangement with the United Kingdom, whereas a lot of the Pillar 2 work is going to be more U.S.-Australia focused, where the UK's role in Pillar 1 is a lot more prominent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I would say, and this is a little speculative because this is a very kind of fresh issue, but, you know, there used to be that longstanding debate about can Japan join Five Eyes? right? And a lot of proponents, again, would make a similar argument that Japan is such a close U.S. ally. There's a deep legacy of cooperation there. But the big kind of inhibitor that I think is also going to be one of the kind of roadblocks in bringing Japan into AUKUS Pillar 2 has been sort of concerns about information security with Japan. And that's not really like a slight against the U.S.-Japan alliance or anything like that, but it's just that the U.S. has had concerns in the past about Japan's ability to safeguard sensitive and confidential information, including intelligence information, when it comes to the debate over bringing Japan into Five Eyes. And I suspect that this will be probably the crux of the discussion around AUKUS Pillar 2, that were Japan to enter AUKUS Pillar 2, you would have a much broader range of information sharing. Australia is a Five Eyes partner, so there is a level of trust there. The U.S. operates the Pine Gap facility in Australia, so there's a level of highly sensitive intelligence cooperation that already exists. Now, my view is that this is probably not an insurmountable problem, which is why this language appears in the joint statement to begin with. But I do think that there will probably be a several-month-long consultation process with the Australians before a final decision is taken. And I'm not going to make a bet on where that final destination will decision will come down, but it's pretty imaginable that, you know, Japan could actually make this work. Because, of course, the joint statement also broadly sets out plans to deepen U.S.-Japan defense industrial cooperation more broadly. And so if Japan were to be brought into AUKUS Pillar 2, I think there'd be a lot of synergies there. And so I can definitely see it happening, but you know, that's my hunch on what the main roadblock there would be.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, there is a reason they put this in the statement, and we will certainly see how far that progresses. And I think there are similar things to watch when it comes to South Korea and other countries within sort of the larger AUKUS idea. Is there anything else in this joint statement that you really want to highlight or in this bilateral before we close up for today?
Well, I think, you know, given that we focus mostly on geopolitics, I think the main geopolitical implications come in the defense and security cooperation issues that we've talked about. You know, like we've emphasized, this is a huge, huge joint statement. Everything from, you know, critical minerals to artificial intelligence to people ties to all the Japanese business deals in the U.S. You know, one thing I do want to point out, though, is, you know, we're recording this on April 24th, I thought it was really interesting that former Japanese Prime Minister Taro Aso just met with Donald Trump in New York, because I think it sort of speaks to the, of course, the anxiety that exists about the election in among many U.S. allies. And Japan, I think, has given this issue quite a bit of thought after, as you remember, Katie, in 2016, when Shinzo Abe had to rush to New York with a golden golf club after Donald Trump won. And I think Japan is trying to make sure that whatever happens in November, that the outcomes of this summit and the alliance more broadly will hopefully be able to survive. And it's interesting that Trump's meeting with Aso, you know, seems to have gone fairly well. I mean, the readout was kind of very normal, you know, in that he sort of supported the U.S.-Japan alliance despite his longstanding misgivings about the Japanese Japan sort of economic activity in the United States, which doesn't seem to be have been a huge issue. So I just thought that's interesting, especially also meeting with Trump so soon after Kishida's state visit to Washington. I think it's an interesting piece of evidence that I think Japan is trying to ensure that it can keep the U.S.-Japan alliance above the partisan fray in Washington.
Yeah, I'm glad that you brought that up, and sort of we can end on that note. But there is certainly a bit of hedging, I think, on the part of all nations when it comes to whatever happens to the United States come November. They want to make sure their interests are secure. Well, thank you to our listeners for tuning in. If you have suggestions for future episodes, please get in touch with Ankit or myself. We're pretty easy to reach. And wherever you're listening to this podcast, please leave a review, recommend us to your friends. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Talk to you soon, Katie.